tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before AA personality. And now, it is indeed, again, another pleasure for me to act as your voice in the introduction of this all-important part of the overall AA program, that of Alateen. Now, this morning I was able to, through my alcoholic way of thinking, rationalize myself as being an Alamon because I'm married to an alcoholic. And I am one myself. But try as I will, I cannot rationalize myself as being an Alateen, although I'd love to be. These kids are great. They have learned a lot. They are learning a lot about the disease of alcoholism as it pertains to them. They've got a jump on so many of the youngsters that we see who today are being bombarded by drugs, the abuse of alcohol, and many of the other things that seem to be so prevalent in our today's society. But these youngsters, who are sons and daughters of we who are AA parents, have an opportunity to live with the problem in their homes, to advise other youngsters who might be faced with the same thing into an awareness and a better understanding of how to cope with this, and to be able to perhaps prepare themselves for a life that will be free from some of the torments of hell that we have gone through. The young gentleman I'm about to introduce is the son of a very dear friend of ours. He happens to come from my hometown of Statesboro. He recently arrived there on the scene in the past 2 years, has certainly been accepted for his fine attitude and the wonderful work that he does as a student in our school. He is looked upon as one of the young leaders in our community and certainly in the Alateen program. And I give you Don C. Don?
Thank you.
I am Don Comer of the Statesboro Alateen Group. I'd like to welcome all of you here. See a lot of you out there smoking. I'd like to encourage you to do so, because all Alateen people like to have a little smoke screen between us and y'all. Now, I'm just glad to see all of you here, and I'd like to begin the program with an invocation by Father J. Charles Willis, the St. Francis Xavier Church here in Brunswick.
First, a word of explanation to those of us who are not fortunate enough to be teenagers. I had a hint that the overall complexion of this meeting was geared to the teens, and that happened to agree with my overall thrust as a priest at the moment in charge of the CYO here locally. And so, speaking for them and with them as one of them, at least in heart, if not in age, I suggest that all of us remember that we are all children of God, and as so, we should hope to grow both in our awareness of the human condition, of diseases of the humankind, and of understanding of one another. In the spirit of youth, then, let us all pray to Almighty God. Dear Lord, let us grow daily in wisdom, age, and grace. This was the gospel formula for the young Christ. It must be the gospel formula for us all. Christ grew till he stood a man, obedient to God his Father, kind to all his people, one with his chosen apostles, as he was to be one always with those who chose him for their Lord and their guide. We are young people, We are eager for truth and health and justice. Let them all prevail. We shall grow older. Let this growth be in faith, in charity, and in understanding, until we shall all unite with Thee forever. Amen.
Thank you, Father Willis. We'll begin the meeting, as we do all our meetings, with a preamble. This afternoon, the preamble will be read by Kathy P. of the Edgewood Alateen Group.
My name is Kathy P., and I'm a member of Edgewood Alateen Group in Columbus, Georgia, and I'm the daughter of an alcoholic. And I'd like to read the preamble. The Alateen Groups are made up of children of problem drinkers who find that meeting with other children of alcoholics is helpful. We realize that even though the alcoholic may have joined AA and the non-alcoholic joined Al-Anon, we ask their children can play an important part in reuniting the family. We urge you to try our program. In Alateen, we have learned to become individuals. We try to realize that alcoholism is a disease. In studying the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, we learn to accept the fact that we are powerless over alcohol and that we can develop the ability to detach ourselves emotionally from our parents' problems while continuing to love them. Our changed attitude may inspire the alcoholic to seek help, which may individually lead him or her to AA. So there is no need for discouragement, even though the alcoholic may still be drinking. We try at all times to reassure our parents that we do not discuss them at our meetings. Our sole topic is the solution of our own problems. We will always be grateful to Alateen for giving us a way of life and a wonderful, healthy program to live by and enjoy.
Thank you, Kathy. I hope this helped all of you understand a little bit better the program of Alateen for those of you who do not have children in Alateen or children at all. And now we'll have the 12 steps read by Laura E. of the Hill Alateen Group.
Hi, y'all. Oh, come on now. I know y'all can do better than that. I'm not through. I know there are a lot of fellow Augustans out here, and y'all wouldn't dare want James Brown to be ashamed of his soul city. And so how about y'all putting a little soul into it when y'all answer? Hi, y'all.
Hi.
My name is Laura E., and I'm a member of the Hill Alateen Group in Augusta, and I'm the proud daughter of an alcoholic. And now I'm going to read the 12 steps, and these steps have done a lot for me, and I hope they'll do just as much to everyone else. 1, I admitted that I was powerless over an alcoholic and that my life had become unmanageable due to a sickness which I did not understand. 2, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity after years of living with fears, suspicion, dishonesty, and distrust. 3, made a decision to turn my life over to God as I understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless inventory of myself. I found that over a period of years, I had built up a pattern of living that was no credit to me or to my character. 5, admitted to God, to myself, and other human beings the nature of my mistakes. Above all, I had developed a self-pity, hurt pride, and resentment and mistrust that was driving me away from society, friends, and God. 6 and 7, I am entirely ready for God to remove all these defects of character and humbly asked Him to remove all of my shortcomings. 8, I am willing to make amends for the mistakes of the past and to constantly be on the alert for any destructive habits. 9, when wrong, I will promptly admit it. 10, we'll continue to take personal inventory. This I must do in order to keep from developing these defects of character, which through habit may creep back into my life. 11, I will speak through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. 12, having had this spiritual experience through the help and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and having had my heart warmed and my soul fed by friendliness and love as exhibited in this organization, it is my earnest desire to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all my affairs.
Thank you all. We're very fortunate today to have two good speakers. One is a very pretty one, and the other one's, well, the other one is a very good speaker also. We'll start off with prettiest things first. And now from the Greater Atlanta Group, I give you Valerie B.
Hi, I'm Val. I'm 17 years old. I'm an Alateen member in the Greater Atlanta area. First of all, I'd like to tell you that my story isn't one of those long, drawn-out emotional ones where everybody's yelling at each other and where I get beat up all the time and things like that. It's more, our family had more of a hidden, it was more emotional, everything that happened. And we tried to hide everything, like when my mother and father would fight or something, instead of, you know, having it out and everybody knowing what was going on, they'd just walk around and wouldn't speak to each other, and our whole family, you know, just sort of snubbed each other and we just didn't speak. And everything just built up more and more. And it never had any outlet. Everything was just within. My mother is the alcoholic in our family. And the first time that I ever heard anything about my mother's drinking was when I was in about fifth grade. And my parents came home from going out to a party or something, and I was in bed, and I heard my father raise his voice and said something about my mother drinking too much at parties and whenever they went out. And so, you know, I was shocked. I didn't know anything about it, but I just sort of kept it in my mind, and I thought about it that night and then a couple of weeks, but then I just sort of let it go, and I never said anything about it, but it was still on my mind. And then about, it was as long as maybe 6 months later, it was still in my mind, and I never had said anything about it. And when we were going out to dinner, and my mother and I were walking along, and I just said, okay, now. So, I mentioned it to her, and she said, she just brushed it aside, saying, oh, that was nothing. Your father was just in a bad mood. And he apologized about it later. It was, you know, irrelevant. He didn't really mean it. So, you know, I took this. It was plausible. So, ever since I've been a young child, my mother and I have always been very close. And I've always been able to talk to her about anything, you know, and you never can trust your friends. Even your best friend, you never really and truly know that they are really going to keep your secrets a secret. But your mother is just one person that you know will. Well, I knew my mother would. And I've always had, you know, she's been my most loyal friend, really. And I could just tell her anything I wanted to. knowing that she would listen to me and understand and keep it to herself. So when I was in around the seventh grade, we found out that we were going to have to move to Atlanta. And my father was transferred from Minute Maid to Coca-Cola. So we moved to Atlanta and in August before I was going into the eighth grade. And in Orlando, Florida, where I used to live, I would be going into eighth grade, which would have been last year of grammar school. But in Atlanta, that's the first year of high school. And that was sort of a, you know, something that I couldn't exactly adjust to because I wasn't ready for high school. And I didn't know how to react to this huge school of 1,500, and my school had 250. So I was just sort of lost, and I didn't really try. I didn't want to move, see, and so I just went about everything in the wrong attitude, didn't like anybody, didn't really care. But then I'd still say, oh, nobody likes me. I think I thought everybody was supposed to, oh, look at that new girl, you know, she's, let's go over there and be friends with her. I know she'd be real friendly. I mean, I didn't show any friendliness, so why should they be friendly to me? So I went on throughout the whole eighth grade being miserable, and one of the big reasons was, first of all, my mother was very lonely because she had my little sister, Tricia, was only a year old, and so she didn't have any time to get out and meet new people, and this was, I guess, a good means of feeling sorry for herself. And my brother, he was in seventh grade, and he was Mr. Popular in seventh grade. You know, he was real, he's, you know, not bad looking, so all the little girls just loved him, called him up every night. You know, had a new girlfriend every week and go to the parties on Friday night. And his dead high school eighth grade sister just sat there at home, you know, and I felt real good. And I resented him. I really hated him at the time because, you know, I was older than him, so I should be able to do more things than he and, you know, excel. But he, instead, it was the other way around. And I guess he kind of resented me for being such a dud, you know, so we just didn't get along at all. My father and my mother just never spoke that much. And then my brother and my father, they've always had this wall between them. And my father's, you know, sort of a perfectionist. He wants everybody to do what he wants, and he's always right. And so my brother is never right. And so it just didn't work because my father is always at my brother for being wrong. And so there was never any peace in our family if it wasn't between my brother and not between my brother and my father or my father and my mother. There was always something, action going around, you know. And so then ninth grade, my brother moved up to the eighth grade, but now he was lowest man on the totem pole. All of a sudden, instead of being Mr. Popular in, you know, a class of 70, he was, you know, in a class of about 400 eighth graders, and he wasn't any better than anybody else. And so at last he kind of looked up to me for advice, and, you know, and I'd been in high school a whole year, so I knew everything about it. So then my social life, well, I was sort of noticing that people weren't going to come to me, so I better go to them. And so I started making a few more friends, and things were getting a little better. Then in 10th grade, I was at last dating, you know, once in a while, at least I dated once. And my brother was, and I were getting, we were getting better, at least we were trying. But my brother and father were really going at each other, and my mother, I guess this was her most heavy drinking period. The last 3 years when we had moved to Atlanta were her heaviest drinking years. But anyway, in the middle of the 10th grade, on January 20th, 1967, my mother called AA. And this was something that we didn't know about. Well, first of all, I've got to tell you about how my feelings were towards my mother's drinking. I did not realize that my mother was drinking. Now, maybe I I realize now, maybe subconsciously, I knew, because I know now that I hated to see anybody with a drink in their hand, especially my mother. I mean, I just couldn't stand it. It just, you know, seeing her with the drink, just, I just got very irritable, but I didn't know why. And I really never, ever knew that my mother was, that any effects that that she had were because of the drinking. And, you know, I was very close to her, and I'd be talking to her. And then I'd go over to my friends. I'd come back about 2 hours later and start talking to my mother, and all of a sudden she was just irrational. I just didn't understand at all, and I'm not kidding. I thought my mother was mentally ill. I thought that there was really something wrong with her mind, you know, and it really upset me, because I guess maybe this upset me as much as, you know, thinking that my mother was losing her mind as much as knowing that she was an alcoholic. But so then when mother called AA, my father and mother, my father's in Al-Anon, they started going to these meetings at least 4 times a week, and my brother and I were appalled. You know, my parents were going out all the time, and they're being nice to each other and talking, and and they were being a lot nicer to us. My mother wasn't ever, you know, in her irrational states as she had been before, and when they first started going to the meetings, my father said that they were going to these mental rehabilitation program or something. And my mother is very, very nervous, and she almost had a nervous breakdown when I was in about second grade. So, you know, I said, yeah, well, okay. But I didn't really believe that wholeheartedly. It just wasn't quite complete, but, you know, I accepted it. And then I thought, well, eventually they're going to tell me what they're really doing, you know. But they didn't. I went through the whole 10th grade not knowing where they were going every night. I didn't know where they were going. And I never, you know, I said, well, give me a phone number, you know, thinking I'll call, you know, and find out what. They never gave me a phone number. I just didn't know what they were doing. So we were on a vacation in the summer of 1967, and my father was sitting in the living room. He was sitting in a couch here, and I was sitting, like, right here, and there was space in between. And he calls my mother over there and says, 8 o'clock on Forsyth Street, or something like that. And I go, uh-huh. And so I look over and see what page number in the newspaper he's looking at. And checked it, you know, and then just continued whatever I was doing in my chair over here. And then they left, and I got up and picked up the paper, you know, turned it to the page, 8 o'clock, Forsyth Street, okay, AA. So, okay, I know, I was so happy, at last I know what they're doing. Oh, and so what was really ironic is when my father first told me, we're going to these mental rehabilitation program thing, I said, oh, is it kind of like AA? And he goes, oh, yeah, And it was really funny when I found out for sure. And so then I run and tell my brother, and he said, well, it's about time. See, he knew that my mother was drinking. I didn't. So then I didn't say anything. I let them go to their little meeting and everything. And then when we got back to Atlanta, Mother and I were going to the store one day, and I said, Mother, I really can't stand it. When are you going to tell us where y'all are going? And she said, it really bothers you. And I said, yeah. I said, I think I know where it is. And she said, where? I said, AA. She said, you're right. And so then she starts telling me about Alateens, that there's a teenage group for all the, for everybody's children to come to. And I just was so eager to come. I couldn't wait, really, because I guess maybe I was a little scared to go the first time not knowing anybody. But I really wanted to go since I'd been so interested to find out what they were doing. Now I was really going to find out everything. So then my first meeting, that was really great. I've never felt such a wonderful feeling of fellowship. And I know everybody who, on their first meeting, whether it was AA, Al-Anon, or Alateen, you all have this feeling of everybody's got the exact same problem as I, and they're all working for the same goal. And it's just wonderful because You know, you have your friends at school, but I never, well, me not knowing that my mother was an alcoholic, I never talked to them about it, you know. But a lot of kids never talk to their friends because their friends might listen, but they won't understand, because you just don't understand unless you've had the same problem. And here's 25 or 30 kids all with the same problem in the same room. And you can just tell them anything you want, and you know that they'll say, I know exactly what you mean. And it's really great. So after that, I continued going to Alateen's, and things really started looking great. I mean, I had a whole new outlook on life, because the biggest thing, you know, first take your inventory. Well, I sure had a big inventory to take. I think for the first time I realized what my biggest fault was: criticism. And I found out that I wasn't so perfect, that it was everybody else was a lot better than I was, and I was just seeing my faults in them, and I just better look at myself before I start judging others. And whenever I met anybody, you know, a new girl in school, oh, she's got a big nose, you know, or oh, I don't like her shoes. There was always something about them, even if they were the greatest kid and I really loved them, and they had a great personality. There was always something I could find I didn't like, and it just got to be automatic. You know, I always see something, and so that's the biggest thing that I've worked on. And I know that we have slips, just like AA has slips, in your mental thinking, because you change your thinking. It's not negative, it's positive. And so now I try to find something I liked in everybody. And every once in a while I meet somebody, or I'll be standing talking to somebody, and I'll start thinking of these ugly things, and I'll say, hey, stop, you know. And it really works, because if you just work on something, you're really going to improve. And if you're sincere and really want to. So now my family, it was really terrific to see the change, because first of all, my brother and I had really been in each other's throat for about 3 or 4 years, and now all of a sudden we're both trying so hard. We're both going to Alateen's, and we've gotten so close. It's just wonderful, because when everybody says, well, I wish, you know, if your children are that we're only 13 months apart, and being that close, you know, we could really be good friends. And we really are now, and I can talk to him. He'll give me advice on what I should wear, and what all the, you know, boys like, and I'll tell him about what all the girls like, and he'll talk to my boyfriends, I'll talk to his girlfriends, you know. And we're just best of friends. I guess once in a while we have a little argument, but it's just such a difference. You wouldn't believe we're the same two people. But now he's in Riverside, and I really miss him, because I really love him. He's great. And but whenever he comes home from school, we just talk for hours about everything. And it's really great. And my mother and father, I really used to worry about if my parents loved each other, but now I know that they just didn't like each other, but they loved each other, and now I can really see that. And my father and my brother, now that of course my brother will never be perfect, so there'll always be some problem my father can find, but I think my father's trying to overlook those problems, and my brother's trying to improve them. So I think that it'll never be perfect, but it's getting better. And now there's one of the biggest things: God. At the same time that I was a member of Alateen's and starting Alateen's, I was also becoming an active member in our youth Young Life at school, and it's a non-denominational group of fellowship of Christians. And for the first time in my life, I asked Christ into my life, and I gave my life to Him, and He became in my heart, and He'll always be there. And and he's my friend. And I think, see, I have my own special program. It's Christ and God, not just God. And Christ, he's my friend. He's always there, no matter, you know, if I have all the enemies in the world, I know I can talk to him, and he'll be there, and he'll understand me. And he'll listen to whatever I have to say. And I have this little saying that AA is love, love is God, and God is my life. And I just like to add one more thing, that if any of you have children that are 12 and over, especially, if they're not in Alteens or if they don't know about Alteens, please let them come, or at least tell them and give them the opportunity, because you can see that, I mean, I didn't really have that tough of a time with my mother, but I was really hurt, and I have just found so much, I mean, I found a way of life, and just as you have, they can find it too. And you may not think, well, I'm not drinking now, so they're not affected, but that's not true at all, because I didn't start going to Alateens till 6 months after my mother was sober and in AA, so that really doesn't apply. It's not true. They are hurt, and they need Alateens. And if your children are even like 5 or 6, don't think that they haven't been affected, because I tell you, they have. It might be just neglect. I mean, they might not know anything about the alcohol, but they know that sometime you've neglected them, or they need love. And when they get old enough, they will find a better way of life. And I wish that Alateens didn't have to be just for children of alcoholic parents, because I think everybody needs Alateens, because they need God. And if you could get your children to come, I know that, well, we have my mother in AA, my father in Al-Anon, and my brother and I in Alateens, and our family, it just couldn't be any happier. And I just hope that y'all's family is as happy as ours.
Thank you, Val. It was very inspiring for all of us. And now, I'd like to let you all know that smoke screen has been established. I'd like for somebody to step back to the back and extinguish CDC's cigar. Now we have our second speaker, and I know he'll follow up along with the first one. And now from Columbus, Georgia, from the Edgewood Group, is Mike M.
Thank you, Don. It really embarrasses me to get up and speak after that. As Don said, my name is Mike M. M stands for Medlock. Don't tell anybody, unless you want to, because my father's name is Medlock. He goes by Medlock instead of his first name, Elwin, which no one can say, so you have to say Medlock to know him. But anyway, I am the son of an alcoholic and an Al-Anon. My father started drinking when I started noticing he was drinking. I was about 12, 13 years old, maybe. But anyhow, let me tell you this before we get started. I was asked to speak at this convention, and I told my father, and my father said, no. I said, why? He said, well, I've been in a going on 6 years, and you've been in Alateens 1 year, and I hadn't been asked to speak at a convention yet, and I don't like it. So I told him I'd put in a good word for him. Just a few minutes ago, coming over to get dressed, my mother's got on this dress I like. It's a little short. I sort of like it. Mother doesn't. But anyhow, she stands up in a chair, check in the mirror, looking to see if her dress is long enough. Isn't that stupid? Stand up in a dress and looking into a mirror to see if your dress is short enough or long enough. Never heard anything about that. But oh, I was talking to one of my good friends. He was a good friend. He told me, he said, Mike, he said, you from Columbus? No, I said, yes. Really, I'm from Phoenix City. That's just, I open my back door and I see Columbus's front yard. But anyhow, he said, you know, the convention next year is going to be down in Columbus. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, he says, you know, I got a lot of influence down there, those people in Columbus. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I'll tell you what, Mike. He said, if you do a good job, I promise you that I'll have you speak next year at the Georgia State Convention. I told him not to be my friend. I didn't want any of his help at all. Now, really, it gives me a great pleasure to be here today. And if it wasn't through our teams, and if it wasn't through AA, I wouldn't be here, because I'd known nothing of our teams if it wasn't for AA. As I said, my father, when I realized my father was drinking, I was about 12 years old. And so he was sort of hiding it, you know. He'd be sitting in there on the table, and he'd walk to the kitchen, to the bathroom, and get him a drink, and go back, you never know it. Well, anyhow, this started going on, you know, and finally, you know, he keeps on making such a pathway to the bathroom, you know. You get where you notice this. Well, anyhow, it keeps up, and then full along, you know, he'd go anywhere in the yard. If he's out in the yard, if he wants to walk over to the side of the house, he can pull him a bottle out and take him a drink. Go to the front yard, pull up the water meter, stick his hand in there, and get him a drink. Walk around to the side door, look at another air vent from under the house, take him a drink, just anywhere in the house he wants. Well, my father was drinking just a little bit. He has a real fine job at this time, and my brother and I were both playing sports. You know, my brother was a football player. I told his help. When we go to a football game or a baseball game, my brother was a real good baseball player. He told me he had to sign a pro contract if he hadn't hurt his arm. But he says he's pretty good, so I reckon he is. But anyhow, we'd go to a ball game or something, and my father, at this time, he's drinking real heavily. And we'd go down there, and my father, well, my brother would be at bat, and it'd be a strike. The umpire would call it a strike. My father said, no, that's a ball. He'd get up and argue for 15 minutes with anybody wanting to argue. And then he was waiting on the next pitch where he could start again, you know. So this happens every game, and we sort of get, you know, my brother and I, it sort of embarrasses us because all our friends, you know, and daddy's out drinking. And by the time the game's over with, we have no problem. He's always in the back seat asleep or something. He's going to lay down to rest. He's tired. So it goes on like this. And then one night we went to the ball game, and before we started the ball game, my father had been drinking real heavily, you know. And mother told him he was going to stay home. And he said, no, I'm not staying home. Well, he stayed home. So we left, you know, we go to the ball game, and our cousin comes riding down there hurriedly, you know, looking for us, and we didn't know anything about this, but we go back home, you know, and I believe the preacher was at the house, and we didn't know what anyone was at the house for. And they said, oh, Medlock's committed suicide. I know he has. Well, they had rung the doorbell. No one had answered and beat on it and called, and he wouldn't answer the phone. He was out in the backyard sitting down. But then he was thinking about killing himself, you know. So at the door, at the back door, he was going to help mother out a lot. He put a towel down on the floor, but when he shot himself in the head, you know, the blood would get on the towel and mess up the floors. He didn't want to make her go to any trouble. He was real nice about it, you know, very, very considerate. But anyhow, at this time, my father's drinking real heavily, and he calls his boss, or his boss calls him, and he's about half potted at this time, you know. So he tells his boss he's quitting work. He'd been working with his company, I believe, about 10, 11 years. And he decides he's going to quit because he and his boss had a little argument. Well, anyhow, his boss didn't believe this, so... Well, he believed it, so he called Mother back and said, Louise, he said, you know that Medlock's drinking. Would you please talk to him tomorrow, you know, when he's sober? She said, well, his mind's made up. He's going to quit. Well, my father quit work, and he goes back to work with the people that he'd been working with before. He went to work with Jake's. He's working with Cadet Dairies now. This job lasted maybe a month, 2 months. I'm really not sure it's that long. But anyhow, I remember one night very well. My father, you know, he'd been drinking, and boy, he just wasn't making it home. And he'd been riding to work with this man who lived about two doors down below us. And this man come home, and my father wasn't in the car with him. And we asked him, you know, where he was, and he said, Dad had to work late. So we believe that, you know, and it goes on. It gets a little bit later and later, and, you know, Dad is still working late. So, well, it's about 10 o'clock, I reckon. And a man calls the house and talks to Mother, and Mother said that he told her that Daddy wasn't coming home because he was embarrassed to come home because he was so drunk. So all of us go to bed real nervous and all, you know. We're scared because we love our father, but he wasn't at home. So next morning, you know, we wake up, you know, and the first thing we ask, well, have you heard from Daddy? She said, yeah, he come home last night. He was tired of sleeping in the car. It was cramped up, so he wanted to come get in the bed. So he made it in. But anyhow, he lost this job because of his problem with alcohol, and we moved to Macon, Georgia. And in Macon, my brother, he's about 2 years older than I am, and he built up this complex against my father. You know, we could tell it because of the way he was acting toward my father. You know, he knew that my father was drinking, and he just didn't want to be around him. So I was younger, and it didn't matter to me because when I go with my father to work, he'd always give me money, and I love money, you know. So my brother, one day, I can remember very well, Dad said, come on, let's go to work. And my oldest brother, Kent, said, no, I'm not going. So I went, and ever since then, I went on to work with Daddy. And there was a funny thing about it. Every day we'd go to work, we'd always stop it. There was one certain store, and Daddy would say, well, I'm busy, you know. He says, this is a place you can't go in. I have to go in there and get the linen myself. And he was a laundryman now. He said, I have to go in and get the linen myself. You know, you stay in the car. So this kept on going, you know. And then one day, every day he'd offer me money to go to the store right next to it and say, go to the store and buy something, kid. I'd say, no, thank you. I don't care for anything. So one day I made up my mind, you know, that when he offered me money, I was going to take it. So I'd go over there, you know, and I'd get me, he'd stop, he'd say, you want some money to go get something? Yes, sir. You know, I'd take the money, you know, go get me something. About 12 o'clock, I'm about to die of candy. You know, I'd ate so much. So this keeps on going all day long, you know, man. These people have more laundry. And I never saw a piece of it put in the truck. But they had a lot of laundry, you know. So that night at table, we was sitting down to eat, and Mother said, Mike, why don't you sit down and eat? I said, Mother, I don't want anything. Dad said, well, you shouldn't. Every time I stopped, you asked me for money. And he was paying me off, you know, to get out. So I didn't know what to say. But anyhow, we live in Macon, and here's why our family is torn apart. Before we started leaving, my father promised from Phoenix City, my mother that he'd quit drinking, you know, just be roses, you know. So, she said, all right, she believed it. He's an alcoholic telling a story, you know. So, okay, we moved to Macon while we were up there. What did my father do the first day he's there? I think maybe the first day when we met him, he wasn't drunk, but he might have been drinking. But anyhow, just a few days later, you know, he comes in the same old routine as it was in Columbus, in Phoenix City. But anyhow, up there, you know, we start the school, and this is where it all starts. One day, my father, you know, he just can't hardly make it, and then the next day, it's the same way, it's the same old thing over and over. And so finally, my mother decided we'd go back to Columbus. So she called her sister and told her, you know, to come pick us up, and she left my father a note. I have no idea what this note said, but my mother told me before she left before my brother and I both left school. Now she said, now don't tell no one we're leaving because your father's liable to find out. So I said, yes, ma'am. I went on to school, and I was taking a spelling test when she came to get me. And the teacher said, yeah, can I help you? She said, yes, we transferring today, Mike is. She said, well, Mike hasn't told me anything about this. You know, I wasn't going to tell my teacher. My father's liable to find out. You know, they can get a whipping or something. But anyhow, my teacher didn't even know anything about it. But anyhow, we come back to Columbus. And we there, and my father lives in Macon, I reckon, for about a week or 2 weeks, maybe longer. And here is where everything was so different, you know. I'd been used to living with my father and all, and then now was going around from one of my mother's sisters to another sister and then to a brother or something. But anyhow, we were just having to, you know, just to move around every other week where we wouldn't wear out our welcome. And my father stayed in Macon, and then one day my grandmother told us that my father, you know, a person called next door and said daddy was real sick, you know, and she went up there with my uncle, and they went and brought my daddy back and moved all the furniture back to Phoenix City. And so this was still bad because we still didn't have the one person in our life that we really loved. But at the time, we didn't love him because we didn't like what alcohol was doing to him. We really hated him at the time. But now I understand that I do love my father, even though he was drinking. But anyhow, he was staying with my grandmother, his mother, and he was still drinking when he come back. But he'd come out, you know, and he'd be drinking. And so this would go on. He'd try to talk to mother, tell her to come back, say, I promise you I quit drinking. So mother knew that this was the same old story that happened when she went to Macon. So she said, no, I'm not going back to you. And never, probably. So we was suing my father for habitual drunk and unfit to keep the family. And we was going to have a divorce and all. And this probably means I'd never live in the same house with my father. But something different happened for about a couple of days. My father would come out to see us and he'd be sober, you know. And you had been seeing him for about maybe 2 or 3 years, not four, I reckon, just drunk every day. And you just can't understand it to see your father sober, except maybe in the mornings before he starts good. But anyhow, when he come out there, mother, he had asked mother, would you go see the preacher with me, you know, before you go down to the lawyer's office the next day. So she agreed with him, and I don't know what they said. I'm not even concerned about what they said, because what happened is our family was reunited. Well, my father is now attending AA, and my mother, she had to go to work, bless her heart. She wasn't used to that at all. So she had to go work in an old men's store selling clothes. So now she's working and all, you know, and daddy's working. He's pumping gas now. At first he was a supervisor for a potato chip company. He's all the way down to a gas station pumping gas. No car. We had a car. The company furnished us with all the gas for the car and a truck. And what do we have? A bicycle. If we wanted to go anywhere, we'd pedal real fast or run. So we do this. And we're back together. The bicycle's wonderful. You wouldn't believe it. Everyone needs to own a bicycle when you have no car, because then you can just go places, you know, no expenses. Maybe change the air in the tire there now and then. But anyhow, it's just wonderful, you know, because your mother and the father's getting along, you know, they're not nabbing, gabbing at each other and all, you know, and your brother, you know, he's getting where he likes his father better, and you really love him, and everything's just, you know, getting right back into circulation. Well, as I said, we didn't have a car now, and my mother was having to work on Friday night. Boy, this is wonderful. I can remember it. Every Friday night, Dad didn't have to go to a meeting. You know, I didn't understand what AA was. He was sober. I mean, what could I care about it at that time? But anyhow, on Friday night, you know, this lady would come pick up Daddy and say, where are you going? He says, I'm going to a meeting. So, you know, he'd go. And this happened every Friday night now with this lady. And I didn't know this lady. So one day, one Friday night, you know, Daddy leaves, you know, and I walk back to the curtains, you know, and I peep out the curtains, you know, And I look out there in the car, and some old lady sitting out there up on the steering wheel, you know. And I say, my goodness, why in the world is Daddy stepping out on Mother for that old lady? You know? So, and I didn't understand this, you know, because my mother looks good compared to this lady. I mean, she looks good anyhow, but compared to this lady, she was Miss America. So anyhow, you know, finally, some way I finally understood. But anyhow, this good friend of my father, she come in about 6 months after my father was in AA, and they had this man who went in DTs, you see. My father done quit working in the service station. Now he has another truck again, and he gets to use the truck whenever he wants it, and I think we had a car also. But anyhow, I'm helping my father one day at work, and Daddy stops at this service station. He says, I'll be back after a while. So I climb back in the back of the truck and go to sleep. And I come back, you know, Daddy wakes me up. He says, get in the car with so-and-so, you know, we're going to the hospital. So I said, yes, sir, you know, I didn't know what was happening. So I get in the car, and this old man is doing his fingers like this, you know, and just all up in like that. Man, I didn't know what was wrong with this man. I thought he was going ape or something. So, you know, Daddy didn't tell me anything, and so he was having DTs, you know, he was in DTs. So we get over to Phoenix City, you know, he'd say, feel my finger, feel the radioactive line running through my finger, you know, and he finally explained to me what happened. He'd been alligator fishing, you know, and he threw a man on a different side of the bank of the river, you know, threw a line across and went down his throat, and he swallowed this radioactive line, and it was coming all out through his body. And he had got a razor blade and cut his finger to the bone trying to get rid of the line. So, man, talking about some funny feeling, you know. I didn't know what to think. But anyhow, we get to the hospital, you know, and I open the door for the old man, you know, and he comes staggering out, and I shut the door. He said, oh, you shut my line. You know, I open it real fast. He says, forget it, I got plenty, you know. I said, yes, sir. So we get in the hospital. And my daddy takes me, says, stay here, you know, and I'm still don't know he's in DTs. I don't know what's coming off. So, you know, the man walks in there and grabbed him. Daddy, please tell me, what's wrong with him? You know, he said, he's in DTs. I said, oh, man. So we go up, he says, take this man up to his room, you know. So we took him up to a room, you know, and this old nurse come in, you know. He gets the nurse over there, feel this line, you know, and she reaches down there, you know, feel. No, I don't feel anything. See if you can see it, you know. And she holds it up to her eyes, you know, try to see it. And she can't see it. And she really believed him. And she's a nurse. She didn't know what was wrong with him. And she walked over to me. She said, what's wrong with him? I said, DTs, you know. And she looked at me, you know, like I was sort of crazy. But anyhow, you know, I said, DTs, you know, so she sort of understood what I was talking about, I reckon. But anyhow, she brings him a shot, you know, and checks his fingers again to see where the line's running out. But anyhow, you know, she's very understanding, I reckon. And then Daddy had to take her out in the hall and explain to her what DTs was. But anyhow, this old man, I was talking to the lady just Thursday what happened to him, and she said that he's sober now. He's been sober. He's not an active member of AA, but he was sort of scared sober because his father passed away from drinking, and he was sort of afraid it would get to him, so he sobered up. But anyhow, so finally, 5 years passed, and my father's been in AA for 5 years. So it was my father's birthday, and I attended his birthday, you know, like usual. And this time some Alateens, it was a few girls from Atlanta. The Atlanta group was down also. And one girl from Columbus, which is a real close friend of mine, she said, why don't you come to Alateens? You know, the sponsor had been talking to me the whole time about going to Alateens. And I told her, okay, you know, I would. And my mother would always come over and say, yes, Mike and I are going to Alateens one night, you know. And I'd say, yes, ma'am, we're going, you know. And so finally, you know, I never go when the sponsor asked me, well, you know, this old girl coming, so, you know. You know, I talked to him and all, but she called me on Wednesday, and the meetings was on Wednesday, and she said, Mike, why don't you come go to Alateens with me? Well, I didn't want to go to Alateens. I didn't have nothing for it. My father was sober. I didn't need Alateens. So I said, well, I don't know if I can. I said, Wednesday night, my father goes to Women's State Prison in Wetumpka, Alabama, to carry a meeting. So I doubt I'll be able to make it. She said, well, I asked him. I said, all right. So I hollered back down and said, hey, Daddy, you going to prison tonight? He said, no, why? He didn't say no. He said, why? I said, well, Penny called and wanted to know if I'd like to go to an Alatine meeting, you know, and I told her you had to go to prison. He said, no, just forget it. I won't go tonight. Go to Alatine's. So I done got sucked in on it, you know. And I pick up the phone. I say, well, Penny, I say, she says, oh, good, you can go. And I say, oh, no, you know. I say, well, I'll see you over there after a while, you know. So I go back there. It wasn't no sense in me going to Alatine's. My father had been in a good while. But anyhow, I get over there, you know, and get to talking, you know. I thought I was a big man on the totem pole, you know. My father had been in AA 5 years. And come find out, that girl had called me. Her father and mother had been in AA for 11 years. So it cut me down to about a toady frog stew, you know. So I started understanding Alatine's at this time, and I started going to the meetings and all, and I attended the meetings regularly. And this fine girl, she told me one day, you know, she said, Mike, you know, Atlanta's coming down, and we need a speaker for Atlanta. I said, yeah, you know, and I knew she was hinting around something. Now, mind you, she done sucked me into coming to Alatine's. Okay, and now, you know, what does she do? I have to speak in Columbus. You know, this is my first time. Boy, was I scared. So she sucked me into speaking at Columbus. And then Atlanta invited us up, and Penny naturally agreed that Mike would speak in Atlanta. So this is three times, you know, and I'm getting tired of it. So I say, no, Penny, you'll never do it again. You know the first one who told me I was invited to speak up here? Penny. So she done it again. So see, she's really helped us a lot, and she knows Alatine, and she's really helped me. And in Alatine, you learn a lot. You learn what to do when your parents is drinking or when they're not drinking. I can practice these principles a lot at home, and my father and mother, we don't have a problem at this time. But he can start talking about, boy, you need a haircut, you know. Well, what I do, I just, you know, sort of walk off, you know, just go back in my room, shut my door, you know, and this type stuff. But anyhow, I'd been in Alatine's just a few weeks now, and this old man I'd met one night at Phoenix City Group, he come to AA for his first time, and he was sober. You know, I sort of took a liking to this man. You know, I was real proud. He was progressing real fine, you know, and he was just wonderful, you know, because he was sober. Well, this man has a slip, you know, and it hurts me at all, you know. But anyhow, my father goes out to get him, you know, and this other man, and they bring him back to the church. I mean, bring him back to the house. Well, anyhow, he comes to the house, you know, and this man comes walking in, you know, all blurred eyed and stunk. Good gracious, he had an odor to him. Ooh. But anyhow, he brought him in the house. Daddy brought him in the house. I said to myself, now just what in the world are you bringing this man in this house for? I said, no one's drank in this house in 5 years, and here you come bringing some man drunk in here. And then the time I said that, something hit me just like it was a door slamming on my face. I said, Mike, this could be your father and someone else trying to lend a helping hand to him, and you're going to treat this man this way? Boy, time that flash hit me, I grabbed that man by the arm, and we went into my bedroom, and we sat down, and we tried to clean him up and all, and you know, that man, well, I don't know, I think he had a couple more slips, but, you know, we tried to help him, and that's what I want anyone to do that will help my father. He wants to have a slip. But anyhow, to ball this up, AA is wonderful. AA is, to every one of us, it has a different meaning. To me, AA is balled up in one four-letter word. It's love. Okay, let me explain myself by saying it. When my father went to AA, who loved him? My mother? No, she didn't. Did his family? No. Did any of his close friends that he had, his drinking buddies, love him anymore? No, they disliked him because he couldn't hold himself. But he got in love, and AA, and someone reached out and grabbed his hand and said, we're proud to have you, you know. Said, you just, what we need another one of you, you know, because you have the same problem we have. What are they doing? They loving him. So he goes on to these meetings, and this love grows and grows. And now our family reunited. What? We love each other. One big ball. Hey, hey, everyone you here love each other. If you didn't, you wouldn't be here, would you? No. So, AA is love. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all of y'all for coming and thank my speakers, especially and the people on the program. And now, if you will, we'll stand and pray together the Lord's Prayer to end the meeting. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. It is not temptation, but liberty.